All right, if you're anything like me, you hate running out of food on a trip. It's like a big fear. And so I'm a big fan of snacks during an adventure. And one of my absolute favorite go-to snacks are Wonderful Pistachios. You may be familiar with pistachios and the brand Wonderful Pistachios, but if you're not, they are one of the highest protein nuts out there. 1 ounce serving of Wonderful Pistachios is 6 grams of protein. That's 10% of your daily value. It also includes 9 essential amino acids, and they come with a ton of different flavors, varieties. There's a spicy version, there's lightly salted, there's no salted, there's so many. And every time I go on an adventure, I'm not even lying, I take an entire bag with me. And what's cool too, I love having the Wonderful Pistachio in shell, because then that almost gives me something to do and focus on as I'm paddling or biking through the really monotonous parts of the adventure. Every great adventure is going to have plenty of boring moments, and it's nice to have something to do and also something that is giving you some fuel, like Wonderful Pistachios. So they're one of my favorite adventure snacks, favorite road trip snacks, and definitely leave me feeling better than a lot of other snacks you can turn to. So if you want to learn more about how to fuel your next adventure with Wonderful Pistachios, go to WonderfulPistachios.com to learn more.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy 5 or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey folks, welcome to Adventure Sports Podcast. My name is Mason Gravely. I'm the host. Today's episode is awesome because Alonzo is the perfect guest for our podcast, and I'll explain why. He reached out, said, "Hey, I kind of think I have a story, but this is years ago. Not sure if it's worth a podcast episode. It's nothing compared to other things you have on." And what I love about that, I love telling stories on this show that no one else is telling, that it's someone who's never been on a podcast, who hasn't shared about the story in years, and has just been living their life. And Alonzo here has told this story so well. It's such a great adventure story of friends getting together, doing something they weren't planning on doing, and it changed their lives. It's great talking to folks who are, have a book and are building a career, but it's also so great to just talk to people who are just sharing the story for the sake of adventure. And Alonzo is going to tell us how he got to the Mekong River in Thailand and what kind of led up to this and how it can apply to your life and how this experience has really shaped his life since, 20 years later, over 20 years later. Also, a lot of great advice here for parents. If anybody's trying to instill adventure and a love of nature in their kids, Alonzo's dad specifically did a really good job of that, as we're going to hear. There's a lot of fondness and a lot of great memories that Alonzo shares of his dad pushing his boundaries early in life. So many great things going on here. This is just such a refreshing conversation. And Alonzo, thank you so much. Everything he mentions, there's a book, there's his websites, that's all in the show notes if you want to check out what he does. And sit back and enjoy this amazing story halfway around the world, at least for where I'm sitting. All right, let's dive in. I think we we've ever talked about this river or this style trip in this exact way. Alonzo Guest, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Mason. Appreciate it.
Yeah, where are you coming from?
I am in Nashville this morning.
Okay. Is that home?
It is home. Yeah, it's home since 2008. I'm from Memphis originally, along with the two guys that joined me on the adventure we're going to talk about.
Take us through. I know your dad was a big part of kind of instilling adventure and travel in you. Tell us a little bit about what he did and kind of some of those lessons he taught you that kind of were stepping stones up to this crazy adventure we're going to talk about.
Absolutely. Yeah. So my dad is was a very unique individual. Fortunately, as sad as it is, it's very fortunate that we were able to have him live here in our house in Nashville for the last 14 months of his life. He passed peacefully in late July.
Oh man, I'm sorry.
No, thanks. He was 81. He had been battling cancer, like bladder cancer, and just had some other issues, and he was just kind of wearing out. But my dad was like the nicest dude you would ever meet. Very intelligent. He was in Mensa. He, you know, was very educated. But his biggest contribution to me, aside from just being a very generous, encouraging, and wonderful guy, is he was very worldly. He was a huge history buff. He actually had lived abroad on two major occasions for 2 years apiece. So once was in Vietnam. He lived in Nha Trang on the beach during the Vietnam War. He was not a soldier, not in the armed forces, but he was there as part of USAID, United States Agency for International Development. And he was there to help non-combat missions, I guess. And then prior to that, he was actually in Africa. He lived in Nigeria for 2 years and he was working for the Peace Corps. And so, you know, I could make this a long, long story, but just if I can kind of tighten it up a little bit, he had all these experiences, and these experiences were like in the 60s, right? So this is prior to, you know, I think I'm cool because I went to Thailand or whatever in 02, or some people might think that's pretty cool, and it is. But to me, to live abroad in Africa as an American in the 60s, that is pretty cool, you know? And if you ever met the guy, you would know, but he never met a person that wasn't a friend from the word go. Just a super open-minded, very nice, very conversive guy that was a worldly fellow. At one point, he went to the Goethe Institute for some courses in Germany, and he learned a bit of German. So the guy had a background. By the time I came around and was born, he was very well-versed in the importance, in his mind, of world travel. And so fast-forwarding, when I was 10, he never really made a bunch of money. I grew up very middle class, very...
In Tennessee?
Yeah, in Memphis. Yeah, I grew up in Memphis, along with David Potter and Dave Riggs. I want to give them a shout out,
The two Davids. The two Davids in the story.
Exactly, yeah. David Riggs is my business partner. But anyway, we grew up in Memphis with not a lot of money. My dad was very thrifty, very frugal, and we saved, credit to him, we saved our money for experiences, not things. So when I was 10... we took a family trip for 2 weeks to Costa Rica, and it blew my mind. We actually stayed the first week. We kind of did some mildly touristy things and stayed. My mom was with us at that time, and then she had to head back after the first week. But for that first week, we kind of hung out on the beach, actually in a town called Tambor on the west coast of Costa Rica. It was just great. You know, as a 10-year-old, this blew my mind.
Did you have any siblings there too?
I'm an only child, okay. Man. Only child,
you and your, so you and your dad just bonding.
Well, it was me, my dad, and my mom initially. So after that first week, my mom had to fly back because she was working, had to get back to work. But as soon as she flew back, my dad and I found our way to his old Peace Corps buddy's place. He had like something like 50 acres in the jungle that came up to the beach. You can't actually... wherever he was, you can't own the beach, right? So he had this beautiful 50-acre, not even a plantation, but just sort of a crop of palm trees and papaya trees and banana trees. And this dude literally lived part of the year, like half of the year down there, in a hut that he built next to a river. His only running water was a creek, and he purified it through filters and stuff. But we did that with that guy for a week. and it was amazing. We were eating, you know, homemade banana, what he called banana fruit tape, which is like a bunch of dried fruit that he rolled up, and it formed like fruit, you know, your au naturel fruit roll-ups.
Yeah.
But so that experience really, really, I mean, the bug bit me, man. I remember coming back. It was a winter trip, Christmas break, or a little bit after Christmas break. Came back, and I was in the fourth grade at the time. And I just remember staring out the window in school thinking, this sucks. I really want to go back to Costa Rica. But anyway, the travel bug bit me. And then fast forward through high school. And then, you know, when it came time to go to college, my father encouraged me very, very strongly to look into a program that was heavy on study or work abroad as part of your college credit. So we landed on LSU, Louisiana State University in Baton Rouge, and the landscape architecture program. I wound up starting and finishing and getting an undergraduate degree in landscape architecture there. But it was a phenomenal program, one of the best undergrad programs for landscape architecture in the country, but also they have a very strong emphasis on study abroad. They actually require their students to either study abroad, and they usually, it depends on the year and what connections they have at the time, but there's usually three or four different locations around the world that you can choose to study for a semester and get credit.
What are you doing when you're out there? What do they have you kind of studying? I mean, how does it apply? What does studying abroad help with landscape architecture? Maybe just variety of techniques?
I chose door number two, which was work abroad, because in order to get accredited landscape architect, you have to have work credits. And I got class credits plus the work credits. I never wound up going, fast forward, I never went down that road of getting my accreditation and being a registered landscape architect. But if I were to do that, I would have already had credits built up from my work abroad. But if you're in the study abroad, you're actually in classrooms at other universities. Like the year that I went was 98, and some of my buddies that I was in school with at LSU, they went to Edinburgh, Scotland, and they were actually in university there. So they participated just as any foreign exchange student would. I opted to go to Thailand because when my dad was in Vietnam, so my father's time in Vietnam allowed him to travel a little bit of that surrounding area. And one of the places that he went when they had a little downtime was Thailand. And he, you know, again, this is in the 60s, man. This is before any of the backpackers hit it. It was, you know, not long before that, it was called Siam, you know. So it was a very exotic land. Beautiful, wonderful people, extremely good food, inexpensive, tropical, kind of a paradise, right? So my dad was really sold on Thailand, and that was one of the options for the work abroad. So the two options that I had were Taiwan and Thailand, and he's like, you got to do Thailand. And it didn't take much convincing. He was one for one with the Costa Rica trip, so I thought I'd give it a second go here with the Thailand. So I spent a semester of in Bangkok, and was actually, we were asking about this earlier, I was working in a landscape architecture firm. So I was helping to design the hardscapes and the plantscapes for various hotels around Southeast Asia and in India. And the work was interesting, but my interest immediately, I was just gravitated more outside of the office. I probably wasn't the best student to have had there. Although I did, you know, enjoy it and was engaged, I was a lot more engaged with just making my 6 months in Thailand count. And hey, if this is YOLO or something, whatever, if this is the last time I'm here, I want to really experience this. I want to travel around Thailand. I want to see if there's another opportunity to go somewhere else. And at one point, my aunt, who is probably the best travel person I've ever met in my life, she was at the time married to Jack Wheeler, who was instrumental in having the Vietnam Memorial Wall built. And they had a fund called the Vietnam Children's Fund. And it just so coincided that when I was over in Thailand, my aunt reached out to me, emailed me and said, hey, because we didn't have WhatsApp or anything like that. So she emailed and said, hey, Jack and I are flying to Hanoi to dedicate one, you know, our sixth school that we built in Vietnam. Is it cool? I've got a stopover in Bangkok. Can you take a little vacation and come with me for a week or two? And I looked into it and got permission from my boss and did. So she met me in Bangkok, and then we traveled to Laos first and spent a couple days in Laos, Luang Prabang. and then went to Hanoi, where I met the U.S. ambassador at the time, Pete Peterson, and then went to this literally his office, and it was kind of cool. I'm like just some grungy little kid from college, and I'm in the ambassador's office in Hanoi, talking, you know, kind of a fly on the wall, listening to them talk about dedicating a school on behalf of Fred Smith and some of the other titans of industry here in the United States that were in Vietnam. So again, further instilled my just love for, you know, travel and going and seeing things that are not familiar.
Man, that is, yeah. What did you, was that shaping your future? What was that causing you to want to do or change or be a part of? Did you think you would stay there? You know what I mean? Like there's so much runway ahead, your mind can really start formulating pretty wild ideas of what your future could look like.
Yeah. Yeah. So I guess you could call it lucky. It wasn't intelligence on my part. It was certainly luck. But fortunately, I kind of understood my place on my timeline of life. And I understood, hey, I do have all this runway, so I don't really want to nail down. I didn't have a specific plan. I kind of knew that I didn't really, sadly, want to pursue landscape architecture for sure. Like my mind had deviated almost immediately once I landed in Thailand. I was like, I got to do something that involves travel. I don't want to be in front of a computer all the time, you know, doing CAD drawings for hotels. You know, that's, I enjoy that. But on the scale of enjoyment, that falls definitely short of travel. And, you know, again, on this runway of being a young guy, I don't know what's, you know, life has got in store for me later. I just knew that I wanted to go back and spend more time and let osmosis take place and tell me what the world, what, you know, what the universe wants me to do that somehow involves international travel.
You go and do this program, you come back and finish school.
Mm-hmm.
And then kind of what's the horizon for me? And I'll say this, I'll preface it with this. When I finished school, I really didn't know what I wanted to do. I knew I wanted to travel. So I spent about, mm-hmm. I basically took a gap year after college to
nice.
Explore the American West specifically.
Mm-hmm.
I thought I would plant roots out there, and I ended up did for like a decade. And, but that was, there was no plan. It was really just, all right, I want to go see these places that I've been reading about in park magazines and guidebooks. I want to see them all firsthand and see what happens. What mm-hmm. was kind of your thoughts at that point?
Well, so I finished school and, you know, I was fully engaged. I didn't quite have the thing that I had in fourth grade after getting back from Costa Rica, where I was staring out the window, luckily. So I was able to focus on school because it, you know, I really enjoyed the program, and mm-hmm. I still to this day appreciate and respect and enjoy the process of going through and doing landscape architecture. All the aspects to it are interesting to me. So I was able to stay focused, finish school with good grades, good marks, whatever. And then I immediately got a job with a very small landscape architecture firm in Memphis, Ritchie Smith Associates, one of the best, maybe in the country, certainly the region, and enjoyed working for that firm for just shy of a year. But I realized during that time, again, I was behind a computer the whole time. I sounds corny to say a salesperson, but I really kind of feel like I belong talking with people a lot more than just being, you know, a computer jockey and yeah. doing, you know, computer work solely. So I then transitioned and found myself a job with a landscaping company, not a landscape architect per se, but a landscaping company in Memphis, where I was designing, but I was also selling, and I was also managing the installation of landscapes. And I really enjoyed that. That was one of my favorite jobs ever. That, and shout out to Chris Pettit Lawnscapes in Memphis. I don't know if you'll ever hear this, but great company,
a lot
great
of
guy.
Name dropping. You know a lot of people.
Yeah. So I did that. So this was a 2-year period. So following, the landscape architecture program was a 5-year program. The undergrad is not 4 years; it's a 5-year because it's very intense. And so I did this work, but the whole time I was working for these 2 years, like starting in 2000 and going up until we actually left on March 20th of 2002 for Bangkok, the desire to go back to Southeast Asia, and in particular to start in Thailand, grew by orders of magnitude. And I just could not, the desire to go back there and the ticking clock in my mind of I'm getting older and I really want to pursue this passion of just getting, you know, getting in the air and flying to a different, you know, part of the world, specifically Southeast Asia to start, really grew. And it just pulled me in. At some point I started talking to my best friends about it. And I was like, hey man, we're young. We need to save our money and go backpacking. I live in Thailand. You guys know that. It really changed me. I want to do this. And, you know, it takes a lot of coordination to make that happen where, you know, especially if you have multiple people, you got schedules, you got parents, you got whatever, your educational plans. The stars really have to align. And fortunately, David Riggs and David Potter were able to see the same thing that I was seeing when I lived over there. And, you know, I was able to convince them both to do this. So the three of us each saved our money up. And on March 20th of 2002, we got I remember the tickets were $500 each one way to Bangkok. Wow. And we stopped, I want to say it was Beijing. It's been a minute, but I believe we stopped over in Beijing at the airport, obviously a few stops, but yeah, we one way ticket to Bangkok, baby.
One night in Bangkok. man, that is wild. What was the plan? What was kind of the selling point for you and your three friends or two friends about making this happen? Like, hey, we're going to go see it. I'm going to this is what we're going to do. Cause it sounds like you didn't know you were going to be on the river necessarily.
Not at all. And I'll throw in this little piece. If you have time, and you're going on vacation somewhere you haven't been, don't make plans. Like, you might want to have the pillars of your travel kind of established, maybe, but life is so much more interesting if you do not have an agenda for travel. I think you need to have plans and an agenda in your work and school life and all that. But for travel, the best things happen to me, at least, when not planning. And that in itself can be an adventure.
Let's take a quick message break and hear from the folks that help make this show possible.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
That is plenty of that for now. Let's get back into the episode. I always say that. Here's what I was... So make the plan to go do something, but the stories and the things you talk about and the things you remember forever, you could never imagine what those are going to be until you go out and do it. Like, you just don't know the randomness that happens and the things you come across. You just leave room for all that stuff to happen. Go out and make it, go out and do it. But all the things you're going to remember, all the stories you're going to tell, you just can't plan on that. There's so many variables at play. Make sure there's room for that stuff to happen.
Absolutely. Yeah, it really is. So we did have a general plan. So I saved $11,500. And I knew how cheap. So Thailand's still inexpensive compared with the U.S. today. But my God, it was way more affordable back in 2002. Just the exchange rate just allowed. I mean, you could eat first of all, the food's amazing there. So you could stay in a grungy little hotel or guest house for like $2 or $3. You could eat an actual meal, like a well-rounded meal, and be full of not junk food, but good food for like $1 or $2. And so I knew that time equals money. That's a pretty early equation to learn in life. You know, as soon as you earn money, you understand that time equals money, right? So I wanted to make this as long as possible. So I was like, guys, we need to start in Thailand. First of all, I know it. It's my, you know, I lived there for a while. I know it. Let's start there. It's cheap. We can get our feet on the ground and get acclimated to the region of Southeast Asia from there. And then, you know, we're not burning through $100 a day. But our main goal was to go, we wanted to go around the world because I wanted to see the places that my dad lived. I wanted to see Nha Trang in Vietnam, and I wanted to see where he lived in Nigeria. Sadly, to this day, I have not seen either of those two specific places. But our plan was to go around the world. We were going to start in Southeast Asia, hit whatever we wanted to hit around there, let kind of the wind blow us in whatever direction, but eventually make our way west through India and then Africa and then South America and then back up. We fast forwarding, and spoiler alert, we didn't do that, but that was our general plan.
So once you got there, what's kind of starting to take shape? Because it took a while to even formulate this idea to boat down the Mekong River. What started happening?
Well, so fast forwarding to the boat thing, we just traveled around Thailand for a while. We did not have a plan for the boat at all. What had happened is we had been in Chiang Mai, which is to this day one of my favorite cities. I haven't been there since 2007, so I don't know how much it's changed, but Chiang Mai is a much smaller city than Bangkok in the northern part of Thailand. It's not on the beach. I'm a big beach guy, like the coast. So it surprised even me to know how much I like Chiang Mai. But we had been kind of hanging out in and around Chiang Mai for a few weeks. And then we decided just randomly that we wanted to head to the Golden Triangle, which is famous historically for being a region where a lot of opium was trafficked because it's a merge of three borders. You have China, Burma, actually four borders, Thailand to the south, Burma to the west, China to the north, and Laos to the east. Anyway, we wanted to go to the Golden Triangle and then take the Mekong River down as far as it would go. And we weren't thinking that we would buy or rent a boat. We were thinking that we would hop on just some tour, you know, some tour boat, not a carnival cruise, obviously, but just, you know, pay some local guys to take us down the river and see the river for a couple of days. That's what, I mean, it's pretty common. People do that. So we found ourselves on a bus from Chiang Mai to one of the border towns in Thailand called Chiang Kong. And on that bus, there were only us as Westerners, Americans, whatnot. And then this one other guy that was traveling alone, his name was Ben Blackburn from Texas. And we, you know, when you're abroad and you see somebody that speaks your language, that's from your country, you immediately gravitate to them and, you know, strike up conversations. So we did that. It was, I forget how long a bus ride was, but a few hours. And Ben was really the kind of idea guy for the boat trip. He, you know, because we told him what we were planning to do, which is rent, you know, some seats on a small tour boat and go down the Mekong. And he said, I want to do that too, guys, but why don't we buy a boat? And as soon as he said that, the three of us were like, absolutely, let's buy a boat and do it. When I was like 12 or 13 years old, my dad and I went camping on the Mississippi River from Cairo, Illinois to Memphis. And it was a 5-day overnight camping trip where we camped on the sandbar each night on the bluffs of the river. And so as soon as Ben Blackburn mentioned that we should buy a boat and go down the Mekong ourselves, I was all in. And luckily, so were Potter and Riggs, their two Davids.
All right. So what are you seeing? What is it like for those of us like myself that have never been there? Describe, I'm sure it varies immensely, just like anywhere can, but describe kind of some of the scenery and setting. Like what is this landscape like?
All right, I'm going to be a little cheesy and also age myself here, but like growing up in the 80s, watching all the like Vietnam War movies, so it looks just like that. As a matter of fact, many of the Vietnam War movies were set in the Mekong Delta. So it's a beautiful river. It's kind of a muddy river, but it's beautiful. It's surrounded by what's called karst limestone topography. So it's big limestone spears or whatever, pyres. in rugged mountains that are covered in jungle, and there's fog and mist in the morning, and there's, you know, you hear all the jungle sounds, and it's a sandy shore of the river, but it's sort of like Predator or something. You know, the movie Predator with Schwarzenegger, you know, it's sort of a jungle river setting, but it's a really big river. It obviously the width of the river depends on where you were at along the river's course, but it's no small river. The Mekong is almost like the Mississippi River of Southeast Asia. It's a major river.
3,000 miles too.
Yeah.
So I mean, I read the 12th longest river in the world. So it starts in Tibet and makes its way for 3,000 miles and varying widths, but it's a massive river.
It is. It's a massive river. The setting is very, it's not boring.
Okay. Yeah.
The river winds and bends, and then some places have rapids. Some places have just rocks sticking out in the middle of the river where it seems to appear calm. It's pretty wild.
And unlike the Mississippi, like you said, it has rapids, but also waterfalls.
Yeah.
So, you know, how much did you know about the part of the river that you wanted to float down?
We didn't really know a whole lot, Mason. So how it started, once we had agreed, I mean, it took about a 5-minute meeting to agree to buy a boat. We weren't sure how to do it.
Yeah, take us through that. How do you do that? That sounds like a big challenge itself.
Well, so we get to this little dumpy little border town, and sorry for the burn, Chang Kong, but, you know, it's sort of a dumpy little border town. We get there, and we had already established our plan. So we get there. Normally, people stay one night maximum in this town, and then they hop on a boat and then go down the river, you know, for however long they want to do it. But we stay there. It turned out, I think we stayed there like 3 nights or something. And the reason that we were there two nights, I know, is because we were trying to tell the locals. Nobody spoke English there. Because it's very off the beaten path. And I luckily spoke a little bit of Thai, not conversational by any stretch, but enough to like say the words of boat and purchase and river and things like this. So myself and Ben, who also knew just a touch of Thai, we kept trying to convince these local people what we were doing. And they did not understand. Every time we would explain that we were trying to buy the boat, they were like, oh yeah, it's only like $20, you know, and in Thai, of course. And we're like, no, I don't think you understand. What we want, we can't get for $20. We want to purchase a boat. And finally, after a few days of being, you know, consistent with our demand to buy a boat, they understood hey, these guys are serious. All right. This has never happened before. No white boys from America have ever come over here and bought a boat and gone down the Mekong. So finally, we found a boat, and I want to say it was around $600 US at the time. And it had a Toyota, not Toyota, but Toyota engine in it. It was a 4-cylinder like truck engine mounted in the back with, and this is all, I mean, it looks like somebody put this together after a few beers in their garage over a couple of weekends. It's a wooden boat that is probably, I should have measured it so I know exactly, but I'm going to guess maybe 20 to 25 feet long. And it had a fixed propeller shaft that went through the hull of the boat out the back, and then a metal propeller, about, I don't know, 8-inch, 10-inch propeller, and a steering wheel that was connected to a wooden, hand-carved wooden spool around which a rope was spun twice and then routed back to a rudder that was behind a propeller. So this is very homemade. It's very Swiss Family Robinson if you add a motor to it. And it didn't have a roof. It was very hot. Southeast Asia, very hot and tropical. So if the sun's out, you're going to get sunburn. Or, you know, the rainy season was about to approach. So we definitely needed a roof. So we negotiated the purchase of kind of a flimsy canopy that looked like something off of like an ice cream cart or something. It had like kind of scalloped edges and had some Thai writing on it. And we lashed that down with string that we bought at a little sundry shop in the village. And anyway, so the next morning, once we purchased this thing, we took some pictures like, hey, we're about to do it, you know, and the town across the river. So at that point was the border. The river was the border between Thailand and Laos. We were on the Thai side. So we had to cross over and get our passport stamped, because much of this trip, as we understood from looking at our maps, and we had pretty rudimentary maps that weren't very specific to that area, but were more general. But in looking at the map, we were like realizing that we were going to be on this river, passing in and out of Laos and Thailand multiple times, no matter how many days we decided to go down the river. But so we had to cross the river that next morning into Laos and have our passport stamped, because the first leg was going to be in Laos. So as we're crossing the river, and it wasn't a crazy stretch of the river, it was just a rather short crossing. Halfway across, we hear this loud clang and the damn propeller breaks. So we shattered a propeller on a rock that we couldn't see under the, you know, under the surface, because it's a very muddy river. So we finally managed to kind of shunter ashore, and then shimmied down the sandy banks once we got it ashore, and we're able to get, we went up to the, whatever the village over there on the Lao side, and it's called that, that town's called Weizai. So we went and got a couple rudimentary tools that we quickly learned, and it was good that we did learn early on, that this was going to happen a lot on our trip, because the river's loaded with rocks that you can't see that are just below the surface. There's wood that's been washed out with, you know, rains. So you might hit a log. Like we were kind of in for a little bit more adventure on the actual water than we had anticipated initially. So we stocked up and got some basic tools. We went down, we actually were able to find, we got the propeller off with some borrowed tools, and then found a little shop that sold propellers and other things, like kind of a hardware store, sort of Home Depot jungle style, very small shop. And we bought, I want to say we bought like 5 or 6 additional propellers just in preparation for this very thing happening again. So we got literally just kind of crawled under the boat, held our breath and reached underneath the boat and got the nuts off and off the propeller shaft, got the broken propeller off and put a new propeller on, and stocked up with a big plastic water tank that we, you know, of course you can't drink the tap water there, but we got it filled up with potable water. And we bought a cheap aluminum cooler and bought as much food that we thought we could keep, because there was no ice or anything. So we really didn't have a lot of really good provisions. We bought a, you know, just as much as we could.
Rice, I assume a lot of rice.
We bought a bunch of sticky rice. We really, you know, again, we were young and kind of dumb, you know, this is, we were in our 20s. So hindsight being 2020, we probably should have bought some more things to cook, but we weren't, we didn't do a whole lot of that. We bought a bunch of sticky rice because we were also thinking, you know, hey, as we're going along the river, we're going to see villages where we can, where we're somewhat naive and thinking that we could procure food every day. And, but luckily we did buy some canned foods, some canned like sardines and things like that, but not enough. So we stocked up and then we set off and we headed on down the river and the boat was going great. My timeline's going to get a little bit messy here, but I'll, you know, I can continue to explain sort of the general progression of the trip, unless you have some questions in between.
I want to hear about what were some reactions by the people that you saw, and also what were some of the true dangers? You know, were there, okay, what's in the water? I mean, I know the rocks and the logs and rapids, which are a big deal. Was there anything else to worry about?
Yeah, so those are great, excellent questions. So the locals thought we were alien. We're in the middle of the jungle, and these are villagers that live a very happy, you know, seemingly happy, but very, very primitive lifestyle, right? They're, you know, most of these villages don't have electricity. They're very peaceful, beautiful villages. The people are smiling and wonderful, but they're not used to people doing this trip and stopping it like we did. Most of these things are speedboats. Like it's a little boat where a couple on their honeymoon might try for a jungle adventure, and then they pay a guy to take them down for 2 hours down the Mekong, and they're going 40, 50 miles an hour on a fast tail speedboat, and they never stop at these little villages. So we, on the other hand, were going about, I don't know, 3 or 4 miles an hour most of the time, putting along like the African Queen, if you remember that old movie. And we're just going down this river very slowly. So we stopped at almost every village that we saw, and the the common sight is always little naked kids playing out by the, you know, the sandy banks of the river. And as soon as they see us, because our boat looked ridiculous, you know, it was this long wooden boat with this clearly ramshackled canopy that's been lashed to it, with at that time, you know, goofy looking white guys.
Yeah, yeah. I've seen the pictures. Yeah, goofy for sure.
Yeah, and they're like, what the hell is going on? What's happening here? I've never seen this. So that is the reaction that the villagers always had. That was consistent throughout the trip. The dangers we knew about, as you mentioned, there are rapids, there are waterfalls, there are multiple convergences and divergences of the river. So we weren't sure exactly, because we could not find, and we did look for it, so it's not, we weren't total fools, but we could not find a very detailed map of the Mekong itself that would show, hey, here are rapids. You cannot cross, you know, you cannot continue. You've got to get out and ford it or whatever. So we really didn't have any good accurate maps of where on the river there would be certain dangers, such as the rapids and waterfalls and all that. So we had no idea. We had some rough idea that we could go for at least a couple days down the river, but it was also, you know, this part of that, of the world, I'm sure still to some degree, even today, is very remote. There's not a lot of big landmarks where it's like, oh, there's the huge skyscraper or tower. I know that we're here. There weren't very many landmarks for us to even associate our location on the river when looking at the map. So we weren't quite sure how far down the river we were, how far we had not come to yet. So there was a lot of guesswork, and our rule from day one, luckily, was always find a suitable sandbar to camp on, at least, you know, 3 or 4 fingers between the horizon and the sun setting, mm-hmm. so that we had whatever, an hour or so. You know, we, that was our rule. We always wanted to make sure before, you know, make landfall and establish camp and get the boat secured and anchored to the sandbar before, you know, well before dark, so that we could set our tents up. See, we had tents and we had sleeping bags. It was full on camping.
Wow. Any animals to deal with? Like, are there crocs in this area? Are there lots of snakes? It's very tropical, and I know that can bring a lot of creatures.
Yeah, no, it's funny. I would have expected to have some cool stories about dangerous wildlife. We didn't see any crocs or anything like that. The only thing that was real sketchy that we saw, and I'll see if I can, after this, at some point soon, send you a clip of this massive centipede.
I did see that screenshot.
Did you see it? Okay. Yeah. So I don't remember what night along this trip that it was, but we woke up and it had rained, because the rainy season, it rained most nights on this trip. And we woke up and we had what are called pack flies. So it's like a rain fly for your backpack. And one of our pack flies was on the ground and we saw something stirring in it, which is never comforting. So we got a stick and kind of lifted it up, and this massive centipede, it's got to be at least 1 foot long, right? 10 inches to 1 foot. And they're poisonous too. Those things will, they're very aggressive too. They will chase you. They're aggressive and they're poisonous. They kill birds and whatnot. I don't think you'd die from one, but it's like the most horrendous looking thing ever. You know, it's a centipede, like you would, you know, you can just YouTube like massive centipede, and that's what we saw. Jeez. And so we have really good footage of me like walking along next to this thing as it was scurrying away, and it scurried around, and they had huge fangs too on the front. So this thing scurried over to like a little kind of a little flooded section on the beach, inland from the beach. And it gets to the water and it looks around, and then I'm like, oh, okay, I guess it can't swim. And then it immediately like swims across really adeptly across this water, and then finds a branch sticking out of the water, and then quickly climbs up the branch. So it never attacked us or anything, but that was the sketchiest wildlife experience that we had.
That is awesome. I read this. It's between 1997 and 2015, the Mekong River basically area discovered an average of 2 new species of animals and plants per week between those years, which is just probably speaks to the remoteness. And that's after you went or right in the middle of when you're there.
Yeah.
Tons of giant catfish that get like 600 feet, crocodiles, yep. Freshwater dolphins, all that stuff. But it looks like a lot of that's changed with the river being dammed. which I don't know the extent of how it's been, how much it's been dammed. I know you mentioned that in your email. Well, take us through, how are you feeling? Like, and by the way, how long were you on it? Like, what's the extent of this part of the expedition or this part of the trip?
Yeah. So, all right. So the Mekong was a total of, Potter and I camped on the Mekong for a total of 10 days. So the first 4 days we camped for four nights in a row. And then we arrived at one of the most wonderful towns I've ever seen, called Luang Prabang in Laos. So we camped out four nights on the river, and then we got to Luang Prabang. It is the old royal seat for Laos. So there's a lot of beautiful gilded temples. There's cars and everything, but it's not like, there's no highways. Luang Prabang's in the middle of the jungle. It's on the Mekong, but at the convergence of another smaller river that I can't think of the name of right now. And it's just a really beautiful, misty jungle town.
Nam Khan.
Okay, there you go. Yes, yes.
I'm following along on the map as you talk.
Cool. Okay, good. Yes. But anyway, Luang Prabang was our stop after 4 days. And we were hungry. Like, Mason, we were eating like old sticky rice. We had some bananas. We had some pineapple, which was delicious, but it gets old after, you know, we had no protein for to speak of for, you know, 2 or 3 days. So we were very happy to get to Luang Prabang, which itself is magical because it was an old, you know, this used to be part of French Indochina. So as you're walking the streets of Luang Prabang, you'll see little restaurants that have a French name. It's all staffed by, you know, Lao people. And there might be an old French person in there that started it in the 60s or whatever. Their menu would have wonderful imported French red wines and white wines. And then I remember my first meal, and I was starving. That first meal, we went to a French restaurant, and it was like $6 US. They posted it in US dollars on the little sandwich board out front. $6, and I got two glasses of red wine, pepper steak, and some potatoes and some sort of vegetable. And it was remarkable. And that was expensive.
Yeah,
I was splurging.
That is wild. Wow. And so, all right, so for the 10 days, I mean, take us through some of the more harrowing parts of this trip, because I know things did not go to plan. Well, they couldn't have. There wasn't a plan.
Yeah, there really wasn't a plan, so nothing went to plan. But anyway, I got to interject, because another good friend of ours that we had met while traveling, his name's Alex Diamantis. Shout out to him too. I'll send this episode to him. So we had met him in our couple weeks, whatever, hanging out and kind of somewhat living in Chiang Mai prior to this river trip. Awesome dude from Manhattan. We met him, just kind of laid back, cool dude, had been traveling for a while. He was kind of taking a work hiatus and traveling the world. And anyway, we ran into him randomly walking up the street when we first got off the boat in Luang Prabang. So we'd met him initially in Chiang Mai in Thailand. And then here we are, fast forward, we're halfway down the Mekong River camping out. We walk through this town and we see Alex again. And we're like, oh, Alex, what's up? So we wound up staying in the guest house, which is kind of like a little hotel. But we got rooms in the guest house that he was staying in, and hung out with him for a couple nights. And he had no plans either. So he was like, hey guys, you have room on the boat? I'd love to join you. So Alex came along, and, you know, again, we didn't have an agenda. We didn't have a stopping point. We were going to take this damn boat as long as it would go. Anyway, so that was cool. So we added plus one to the boat trip. So now it's myself, David Riggs, David Potter, Ben Blackburn, and then Alex Diamantis. And this is a narrow boat, Mason. Like, two people cannot sit side by side on it.
It's like a 25-foot wooden canoe. I mean, it's like a canoe or something. You know what I'm talking about? It's like a canoe that can have a motor on the back. It's almost like that. I mean, I'm looking at it. It seems like a popular style on that river.
Yeah. It's a long tail boat, but it's wide enough. Like, if you're if your girlfriend or your boyfriend is with you, you'd sit side by side, but two dudes that are, you know, you're stretching out, you're not going to sit side by side. It's just not that comfortable. You're kind of packed in. So we had enough room, and we added Alex, and that was great. So we, after staying in Luang Prabang, I think four nights, exploring, taking pictures, visiting temples, you know, just really doing some cultural sightseeing there, and mainly eating and stocking up on more canned foods. And just getting our fill of protein, we set back out on the river, and you were asking about like a crescendo moment or something. There really wasn't one until the very last night. I'll get to that in a second, but we did wind up breaking our propeller like several times on that boat. You would just be cruising down the river, and then all of a sudden, and you're not seeing any rocks or anything. It seems smooth and cool. And all of a sudden, bam, and then the motor jolts and then skips or whatever. And then, you know, it's wobbling because the propeller's broken. Well, one time we that happened, and then the propeller started wobbling because it was off center because one of the tines of the propeller had broken off. The prop shaft started getting really loose. And, you know, there's leaking water coming into the boat around the propeller shaft where it was sticking out through the wooden hole in the boat. And so we were jamming T-shirts down in there with sticks to prevent it from leaking. And then it's at one point, one of the cylinders on the motor went out. So we had like three cylinders. So we're cruising down the river with three cylinders. And then it's knocking and all this stuff. The motor essentially fell apart throughout the course of this 10-day trip. And then at one point, we were kind of just cruising without the motor because we're just drifting down the river. And it was more pleasant than a heavily vibrating motor and noise.
I was going to ask, is the river moving? And it seems like it's moving pretty good in places.
It cruises pretty good in parts. It's kind of like any river where, you know, if it gets narrow, it's going to go pretty fast. Or if it gets shallow, it goes pretty fast. But if it's deep and wide, it's going to go pretty slow. And we would, you know, we were listening to Fela Kuti and Buena Vista Social Club and other, you know, kind of chill music on our CD players with our little speakers and just cruising one day. And we were drifting backwards and, you know, just didn't matter because the river was wide. And then all of a sudden, boom, well, the propeller shaft sticks straight out the back, sort of at a lower, like 15 or 20 degree angle, and it hit a rock. And it jammed the motor up off of the motor mounts. And we really started having water leak into the boat at that point. So we actually, that happened before we got to Luang Prabang. Yeah, that's right. So we bent the propeller shaft and it would no longer work. So when we got to Luang Prabang, that's one of the reasons that we stayed there for a few days, is we found a guy to fix our propeller shaft. His name was Somdi. And to my buddies that were on the trip with me, they'll laugh about that because Somdi, we're like, what does Somdi mean? And he said, Somdi means perfect. But anyway, he was sort of like this Lao guy that wore a suit everywhere. And he was a young kid, but just sort of a hustler in a good way, like wanted to, you know, kind of carve out a little business for himself. But he was our fixer and he helped us get our propeller shaft fixed. I guess they heated it with a torch and then straightened it out on a lathe or something. I'm not sure. But anyway, Somdi fixed our propeller shaft.
Shout out to Somdi if you're listening.
Yeah, shout out to Somdi. But so back to the river after that happened and we got all that fixed in Luang Prabang. Yeah, just continually breaking propellers and fixing them. And at one point we were caught in sort of a whirlpool. I can send you a video clip of that. Yeah, not like anything to suck the boat down, but it would be to the point where, I mean, this is a big boat. This thing probably weighed a ton at least, if not more. And it would spin the boat like a top because the river's bottom is so crazy. It's sandy, so therefore the sand changes a lot. And then you have these rocks, and then it's going around corners and stuff. So it, in certain parts, it could be pretty sketchy. And, you know, there would be whirlpools that you would see, you know, forming right next to you. And then at one point we saw the carcass of a dead cow that was half eaten out by maggots floating right by the boat into a whirlpool. Yeah. So kind of like weird, sketchy, like Heart of Darkness looking stuff.
Yeah.
Very beautiful. Though.
Yeah. Yeah.
The whole area is beautiful. I don't want to taint anybody's perception, but.
Let's take a quick message break and hear from the folks that help make this show possible.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
That is plenty of that for now. Let's get back into the episode. It's yeah, like you said, it's these really it's those beautiful, very steep kind of almost mounds of mountain that are covered in vegetation and jungle and just look like a beautiful area.
Yeah, gorgeous. Just gorgeous.
What? Yeah, I mean, how did you get out of the whirlpools if they sucked you in? Like, were you just trying to maneuver yourself? Did you have paddles?
Yeah, well, no, we didn't have paddles. We had the wooden, our seat. So our seats in this boat were just wooden planks. So we would just, and they weren't nailed down or anything. They were just resting on these rails that were wooden. And so we would just take those wooden seats and use those to paddle.
There you go.
And it took all of us to paddle to do anything to that boat just because it was so long and so heavy.
I didn't realize it was that heavy. Because there wasn't a lot of, you didn't move this thing easily.
No, you did not. It did not move easily. But to get to sort of an adventure. So at some point, it gets exhausting. So this last stretch, so we had decided that we're going to go from Luang Prabang, which took 4 days. We decided that we're going to go from there to Vientiane, which is the capital of Laos. And we weren't sure how long it was going to take, et cetera, et cetera. And we weren't sure. We had been told by villagers and, you know, the few that spoke any English and the people in Luang Prabang that we told what we were doing. They said, close to Vientiane, there's a lot of rapids and, you know, you got to be careful. Everybody's like, be careful as you get closer to Vientiane. So we weren't really quite sure. And again, we could not procure a map that had detailed imagery of the Mekong. You could get a regional map or a kind of an area map, but nothing that would show us what we were up against on the river. So we just cruised. And then, you know, we got to this town, a day before we wound up getting to Vientiane. We got to this little town. It was just really, really hot. And we were running out of food. Everybody was hungry and kind of tired. So David Riggs and Alex got off in that town. We all got off and ate at like kind of a little roadside restaurant, sort of a family little thing where she would just cook up a bowl of soup for you. And we called that affectionately Liver Town because all they seemed to have was like, liver soup or something. Was I'm sure good if I was in a different mindset, but anyway, so Alex and David decided to negotiate a tuk-tuk ride into Vientiane because it wasn't that far at that point to Vientiane by road,
and that's probably one of the bigger towns on the river you come
yeah
across.
Vientiane's the largest city in Laos.
Oh wow.
And it's a city, but it's not, you know, there's not a whole lot of glass and steel there. You know, you have a little bit of that, but it's the capital. It's, you know, it's a pretty decent sized town. And then so Alex and Riggs were off the river at that point. And then Ben, we called him Captain Ben, because he wound up having to hotwire the boat a number of times because the starter wouldn't work or something. So you probably saw one video clip that I showed where I was bailing water out of the boat after it sprung a leak, and then he's messing with the engine. So he was constantly fixing the engine and all that. At one point he slept on the boat and it came unshored from the river bank, and we woke up the next day and the boat was in a different location than when we parked it. And so we went down there and talked to Ben, and he was shaken. And he said that he didn't have a tent, so he was sleeping on the boat underneath the canopy. And he said he woke up and he was cruising down the river, like floating down the river in the middle of the night. And he said he had to paddle it back somehow, or no, he hotwired the boat and boated it back up the river to camp. And it was pitch dark, no flashlights.
That could have been a lot different.
Yeah, he had a pretty good monologue that we filmed where he's explaining his adventure, and he was kind of shaking, physically shaking, the next morning. But anyway, so fast forward back to this place called Liver Town. So Alex and David get off the boat, and then Potter and I and Ben are the remaining three. So there's down to me and Potter and Ben. And we wanted to take it into Vientiane, and we had agreed to the three of us, David Riggs, David Potter, and I would hand the boat over and just give it to Ben. Because he paid more of a share to buy the boat than the three of us did. So I think he paid 60% of it with the agreement that whenever the trip was done, he would have the boat and he could sell it or do whatever he's going to do with it. So anyway, we got back on the boat, and this was the most adventurous or harrowing time of the whole trip for me and for Potter. Of unfortunately, Alex and David missed this because they were comfortably in Vientiane by this time. But we got back on the boat after Livertown, and we had the most gorgeous sunset I've ever seen in my life. The river was really wide and really deep and very slow, and it was just this mesmerizing. It was like the siren's call. We had our tunes playing. We were kicking back, relaxing. We were kind of worn out, so we're like just taking it easy, like soldiers that had been through, you know. Obviously, shout out to soldiers for working hard and dealing with a lot more than we did, but, and excuse the analogy, but we felt kind of worn out from from battling this river, so to speak. And we're just kicking back looking at this sunset, and I realized, oh wow, we forgot our rule to find shore before the sun actually goes down. And we broke our rule, right? We were mesmerized by the sunset and just kind of the scenery. It was just gorgeous. And by that time, the river was starting to narrow, and therefore the water was starting to speed up. And also at the same time we realized that was going on, the temperature was dropping. So it was starting to get, it was getting a little bit breezy. So we sensed a storm was coming. It was pretty evident that a storm was coming. It wasn't on top of us and we couldn't see it, but it felt like the temperature dropping, the wind picking up, and then the river speeding up because it was getting narrower, kind of got us, shook us into action. And we started looking for camp pretty desperately. Camp being any shoreline that was flat enough for us to put our tents on and soft enough for us to put this big spike into the ground that anchored the boat attached to a rope. And we could not see anything like that. The edge, the sides of the river, instead of being flat sandbars, became very steep canyons that were made out of what seemed to be river coral. So very, very sharp, very porous, almost like pumice.
And this is now past Vientiane?
No, because we stopped in Vientiane. That was the destination. But this is like leading up to Vientiane. This is because we had let them off, Alex and David Riggs got off at the town that we stopped at one night before we got to Vientiane on the boat.
Yeah, Livertown.
And then they took us into town. So anyway, we are starting to panic a little bit. Panic's probably a bit of a strong word, but we're very focused on desperately finding a shore that we can actually stake this boat to, because with the river picking up like that and having been warned about rapids, we thought for sure there might be a waterfall coming up. We didn't know. Our maps didn't show it. Everybody had told us, like, you need to be very careful around Vientiane. So we finally, you know, it started actually storming pretty good and blowing, like the wind was blowing crazy. So we found our way over to a shore, and it was probably 45 degree angle slope, if not steeper, of this dark brown, almost black coral, that like river coral is the only way I could put it. And there wasn't much vegetation on it. There was like little sprigs coming out here and there. And I jumped off the front of the boat once we kind of pulled it ashore. And I think we had the engine working, but maybe with like two cylinders at this point. So it was really a poorly operating boat at this stage. Mm-hmm. There wasn't enough power to really get enough speed in order to steer it. So we were kind of really winging it at this point with the seat bottoms, trying to paddle our way towards the shore. Anyway, we found our way towards shore. And I jump off onto this river coral and lash the front of the boat with a little string that I had. I try to stab the spike into the big, long steel spike about 4 feet long. We would just jam into the sand every night. Well, that wouldn't go into this coral. It just was like clanking off the rock. So I wound up lashing this rope around some sprigs that seemed like they were strong enough to hold the boat. So once I got that tied off, we didn't have a rope on the back. So I just was able to tie the front of the boat. And it was a little bit of a cove, like sort of a little eyebrow off of the river, the main channel. So we were tucked in a little bit off the main channel, but we were still hanging out in the river. Like the back end of the boat would swing out. So we kind of hunkered down, man. We had our rain gear on, and I had my parka zipped all the way up around my face and cinched with the cinch cords. And I slept on the bottom of the floor of the boat, just getting pummeled with rain all night, and bugs and stuff would crawl into my parka hood, and I would just squash them. I mean, there was nothing else to do. And we dealt with that for, I don't know, 5 or 6 hours. It literally poured down the entire night, and, you know, the boat would swing. You'd kind of drift off to sleep, and then you'd feel the boat moving a little bit, and then you'd feel it bang against the shore as the mm-hmm. wind blew it against the shore, and then it would jolt you awake. So we woke up very shaken. Luckily, when we woke up, the skies were clear and it was a beautiful morning, but we were all shaken and we had hardly slept because of the previous night being so harrowing.
Wow. Unbelievable. Yeah. I'm looking at that part of the river now. I can see what you mean. No shore, just these ridges and cliffs, and not what you had been seeing so much of before, you know?
Not at all. Yeah, we hadn't seen anything like this the whole time.
Even the river's not easy to identify where it goes.
That it's really, it's very windy. It's very,
very windy.
Windy
and an undefined shore, honestly. So take us through getting to the end and finishing this trip. Where were you trying to get to, and what were your plans, and what did you do with the boat once you got there?
Well, so we had agreed from day one to whenever the trip ended. On day one, we weren't sure that we wanted to terminate the trip in Vientiane. We kind of were along the ride for taking this thing as far as the river would let us go. Mm-hmm. But then the agreement was whenever the trip was finished, we would shake hands with Ben and just hand the boat over to him and let it be his. So after this horrible storm, Potter and Ben and I wake up, and we literally, I think our engine had quit working totally by then, after just a few minutes of starting it, or maybe it wouldn't start after the storm. I can't remember specifically, but anyway, we drifted down the river, and within like 10 minutes of us waking up from that stormy night, within 10 minutes, we went around the bend and there's the Incheon. So if we had just gone another 10 minutes, we could have pulled up to shore.
That's hilarious.
Anyway, so we get off at Vientiane, and we agreed at that point, hey man, the boat's yours, Ben. It's all yours, dude. It's been a fantastic adventure. Keep it. So he lashed it up, and it turns out the next day it went down to go check on it, and it had been stolen, sadly.
No.
I say stolen, maybe it had come unmoored or something, but our impression at that stage was that it had been stolen. And then we hung out in Vientiane for a few days and told stories and had beers and dinner with everybody, just kind of telling war stories and just reminiscing and laughing and talking about it.
Man, that is awesome. What an adventure. So you know, all these years later, you work with one of the folks that were on that. You know, what's one question I like to ask to people who have recently completed adventure is, what's something you think is going to stick with you a decade, two decades down the road? But I get to ask you this, like, what actually has stuck, because this was that long ago. Mm-hmm. What are some of those first things that come to mind when you think, this will always be different about me because of this experience?
Well, I'll tell you, that's a great question. And, a lot of times you can't define, like, gee whiz, that's a good question. I don't know. In our case, I think, so I speak for myself and David Riggs. So small plug. So David and I have a business. We have a factory in Kathmandu, Nepal, where we make our products for our two businesses. One is Sunfish, and our website, sunfishsales.com. And it's golf head covers and accessories. And our other business is walkingpalm.com. Mm-hmm. And we have pet bedding and accessories that we make for Walking Palm. And so, and that's another story. David went off when we were in Vietnam after the boat trip. He went off to Nepal and established some friends there. And that's what led to our business being born. Mm-hmm. That's a story for another time. But anyway, the boat trip to me is very, so we're business owners. We've had this business going since 2011, late 2010. And the biggest takeaway and application of that boat adventure to our business is, and to life really, is that you're all on a boat, whether it's your family or your coworkers, your employees, whatever, you're all on a boat. And the mission is whatever the mission is. If it's the family, you have multiple missions: get your kids healthy and educated and through life unscathed without, you know, damage, whatever. If it's a business, it's to succeed in growing your business and doing a good job for your employees. Mm-hmm. And so I analogize our whatever your day-to-day things that crop up to deal with at work as being on the boat. And you all got to paddle in the same direction. If there's a leak that springs in the boat, you all got to pitch together and fix it. But don't panic. That's the big thing, is don't panic, because it's an adventure, man. Life's short. You're always going to have things that pop up, good and bad. And, you know, if you spring a nitinoy leak in the boat, and Potter and David will laugh at that, nitinoy, small leak, then you just attend to it and fix it and move on. But it's all about being on the boat. So David and I try to analogize our team at work at Sunfish as we're all on the boat together. Sounds kind of corny, but having gone through that adventure, it's really very similar. Circumstance.
You can't go out and do it on your own just because it's right. There's one boat, you know, you're all in it. Wow. No. That's awesome.
Yeah, Ben was the captain. Ben fixed the engine. We couldn't have done that. We kind of did things that Ben couldn't do. We all kept humor going throughout the whole trip. That's one takeaway, is you always got to laugh, man. You always got to keep it light. And if you can laugh your way through disasters and hardships, then makes it a lot easier.
Wow, that is so cool. What a cool adventure that I'm sure has just shaped you and goes back to your dad. Your dad sounds incredible. And you know, one last thing I want to ask about, because I was going to ask you where folks can find you. You were able to share about the two businesses. I think I saw some tattoos. What's the story there?
I've got one tattoo. It's kind of corny. I get made fun of for it. Riggs specifically likes to make fun of it. He calls it the throwing star tattoo. It's just something I drew.
Got it.
Yeah, it's something that I drew. It's on my shoulder. It's this triangle thing. And
got it.
I don't know. There's no symbolism to it.
Well,
really.
I saw one of the pictures that you sent over. Someone was getting one.
So that's another tattoo that I drew, but that was being tattooed the native way. So it's like called a bamboo tattoo. And that was Potter getting musical note artwork tattooed on his ankle.
On
so he
trip.
Got that done. Yeah, he got that done in Thailand. Yeah.
That is hilarious, man. That's awesome. Man, what a cool adventure. Well, yeah. Anything else you wanted to share?
Yeah, one last thing I'll say is if you have kids, and I don't know, I would assume anybody listening to your podcast is probably open-minded to travel and understands the benefits to traveling. I would highly encourage that. So our daughter, I always wanted to take we have one child, and always wanted to take our daughter abroad, like my dad did when I was a 10-year-old kid. So my dad took me to Costa Rica when I was 10, and lo and behold, we were able to align the stars and get our daughter to Costa Rica when she was 10. So that was super cool.
And do you think she had a similar transformation that you did?
It wasn't quite as adventurous, but it was very cool. We saw a different part of Costa Rica, the East Coast, that I highly recommend.
That's awesome.
Not many people go there. But yeah, that's definitely cool. Wanted to take her and set the travel bug in, or at least put the travel bug in front of her.
Give her that chance. You know, maybe it's not her thing, but like, hey, I want to make sure you're at least exposed to what really shaped my life. That's awesome. Yeah, I'm a father and of little ones, and not quite 10, but it's definitely like, okay, what can I do to make sure they have this opportunity and at least know? And maybe it shapes them like it shaped you. And that, man, what a cool story. I'm sure you reflect on it a lot and think back to what of an epic time this was.
Absolutely. Yeah, it was fantastic. I want to do it again. I'm getting to be 46 now, so I'm getting up there, but I never quit dreaming about getting we did a bunch of motorcycle riding through Cambodia and Thailand, and I dream one day of doing something like that again.
Oh man. Well, hey, you know what to do. You know the important things. Just go out, make it happen, and figure it out along the way.
Yeah, definitely. Plug one more person that was also an influence? I haven't met this person, but I have conversed by email.
Sure.
His name's Jim Rogers. He's an old guy. He's like, I think he's a year older than my dad would be if he were around. I believe he's 82, 81 or 82. Jim Rogers, and I, in our emails previously, I'd sent you his Wikipedia. Yep. So this guy wrote multiple books, and I've read them all, and they're all amazing. But his first book was The Adventure Capitalist. I'll just say that. And anybody that's interested in reading a book that greatly inspired me to travel and also to think business-wise about the world, look up Jim Rogers, and the first book that I would recommend is The Adventure Capitalist.
Adventure Capitalist. I will plug that. And yeah, I'll also plug walkingpalm.com and sunfishsales.com.
Awesome.
Yeah. Alonzo, thank you so much. This was awesome.
Yeah, thank you.
Great story.
Yeah, never thought I'd get a response from you, but I thought I'd reach out and see. So thank you. Awesome. Thanks, Mason. Right, yeah. Good to meet you.
You too. All right. See ya.
Take care.
First of all, thank you so much for listening. It means the world to us that you choose to listen to this show. If you'd like to help us further, you can leave a review on iTunes, share us with your friends, your family. It goes a long way to grow in the show. You can also support us financially through patreon.com/adventuresportspodcast. Link is in the show notes. And also, if you have an idea of who could be a good guest for the show, we're always looking for people to tell their story about the outdoors or adventure. So if you know someone, please reach out. Email us at info@adventuresportspodcast.com. And until then, get out there and have some fun.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
If you own a vehicle with less than 200,000 miles and have an auto warranty about to expire or no warranty coverage at all, listen up. CarShield has a low-cost, month-to-month vehicle protection plan that covers more parts than ever. Visit carshield.com/audio to find out how you could pay almost nothing for covered auto repairs. Drivers who activate this vehicle protection today will also receive free roadside assistance, free towing, and car rental options at no additional cost. Get your free quote today at carshield.com/audio. That's carshield.com/audio.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.